British number 10897, Reel 3.
Wing Commander Grimes to Reel 3.
I was saying, Bill Ledley flew due west when we'd taken off from Dra, crossed the coast, and went on flying due west for probably 20 minutes or so before turning north for home. And we were halfway across the channel when I was looking out of the window, and we seemed to be flying in black cloud. And very shortly afterwards, I was conscious of the fact that we were turning round and flying back the way we'd come. And word was passed back from the cockpit that we were going to land at Jersey, because the captain didn't like the look of the weather. Well, the weather turned out to be the smoke from the oil, French oil tanks at Le Havre, which had been fired, and the smoke was drifting across the channel. In fact, it arrived, I believe, so I was told, over southern England, quite noticeably. Anyway, we landed at Jersey. More problems for me. No money, no shaving kit. However, I was financed by a group captain who was on board. We stayed at some hotel in St. Helier. But didn't take off the next day for some reason. So we spent two nights in Jersey and flew home on the... I'd been shot down on the Saturday. Saturday night in France, Sunday night in Jersey, Monday night in Jersey, yes, flew back to Hendon on the Tuesday morning. Meanwhile, of course, my parents on the Monday morning had received the usual telegram saying, "Regret to inform you, your son is missing as a result of our operations. We'll let you know if we have any news." That was on the Monday morning. On the Monday night, they were greatly relieved to hear my voice, because I rang them from Jersey. It was still possible to ring England from Jersey, and said, told them that I was perfectly all right. But they were a bit puzzled when I told them that I was in Jersey, because the last time they'd spoken to me, of course, I was at Biggin Hill in Kent. Well, that's really the end of that story, except that while I was waiting for an aeroplane to fly me from Hendon to Biggin Hill, I suddenly bumped into my splendid instructor at FTS, who was then Sergeant Ridley, Sergeant Pilot Ridley, and was now Flying Officer Ridley, having been commissioned. So we had a little chat, and eventually I was flown back to Biggin Hill about lunchtime. That was on the Tuesday. The following day I learnt I'd been given the DFC, and 3 days after that, on the Saturday, I celebrated my 21st birthday. And that was one hell of a month. I remember my mess bill for that month was just about 2 months' pay. Very difficult.
Did you shoot any German planes down over France?
Oh, yes. I fired at a lot. Hopefully damaged a lot. But my most successful day was, again, after Dunkirk and before the Battle of Britain had started officially. In other words, in June sometime.
After you got back from being shot down?
Yes. Towards the end of June, we were sent off as a squadron to escort some bombers on a bombing raid somewhere near Abbeville. And nothing much happened. And we saw the Blenheims drop their bombs, and we were flying homewards and had crossed the coast just north of Abbeville somewhere when a lot of 109s appeared. And we had a little bit of a battle. And the one I set my eyes on turned north, which suited me because I wanted to fly north. So I followed it, caught it up half a minute later, and started firing at it from very close range. And suddenly the hood of this 109 flew up and passed me. And I stopped firing at that point. And the next thing that happened was that the pilot jumped out. So that was that. And then for some peculiar reason, I must have been slightly aggressive that day, instead of continuing flying north, I turned south and became conscious of the fact that my number two was still with me. And he must have been surprised too to find his leader, instead of continuing north, flying home, had flown south back into enemy territory. We were just off the coast. And with hindsight, I think what I had in mind was that the enemy 109s had obviously taken off from Abbeville. And there might be a straggler, certainly not expecting to find any hurricanes, might be a straggler going back to Abbeville. And sure enough, there at the mouth of the river was a 109 flying at about 2,000 feet, obviously going home to Abbeville. So I dived down on it and suddenly realized I was overtaking far too quickly. And I opened fire at a range, I suppose, of less than 100 yards. And instantly, there were flames from this 109. And that was that. So, two in one sortie was a red letter day. And we'd taken off from Manston that day. And my number two flew back to Manston. And I learnt that two others had each shot down a 109, so we'd accounted for four that day, which was a good day, a good bag.
What was the numerical balance from your own personal experience between the RAF and the Luftwaffe over France in May-June 1940?
Well, we never flew other than as a squadron. Now, that doesn't mean flying 12 aircraft. I mean, for one reason or another, people have been shot down or their aircraft have been hit. A squadron meant anything from 6, 7, 8, 9 aircraft. We hardly ever flew 12 aircraft. So whenever we met the enemy, they never flew in less than 20s or 30s, in 109s. We were always rather outnumbered.
And did the Germans seem to be more experienced in war?
No, as far as I'm concerned. And perhaps I can illustrate that by one occasion off the south coast, doing a convoy patrol. And we'd had a brush with some 109s, very few of them. And I was leading a section of three, and my numbers two and three had disappeared. So had the enemy. So I was left all on my own guarding the convoy. And suddenly, at the same level coming towards me, were four 109s. And we flew past each other, literally at a distance of about 50 yards. And I did what the First World War pilots called an Immelmann turn, which is you pull up in the beginning of a loop and you do a half rail off the top. And the idea is to get yourself pointing in the opposite direction as quickly as possible at a slightly higher than the enemy. And I found that two of the other four were flying straight ahead, and two had started to turn back towards me, and I'd been quicker than they had. And in no time at all, I was firing at the number two to the leader, and he broke off, dived down to sea level, and was away. So I was left with the number one, who by this time was pointing towards me. So I did another Immelmann turn, and he did another semi-Immelmann turn. But again, I was a bit quicker than he was. And he dived away with me firing on him. And I, hopefully, I did some damage, but they flew off into the distance. But they weren't aggressive. I mean, they could have done much more to deter me. But I found I was deterring them. And certainly, over France, if you were... you were usually fixed on one particular aircraft, because everything was milling around. And if he saw you, probably, at the same time as you saw him, a little aggressive manoeuvring usually meant that he would break away and dive to ground level. And of course we'd been advised never to follow an aircraft down, for obvious reasons. They were diving back home, as it were, and if you dived after them, you were quite likely to be caught. So one didn't dive down, and you were left alone in the sky.
How did the transition from the Battle for France to the Battle of Britain come about, as far as you remember it?
Well, curiously, as far as I was concerned, the Battle of Britain didn't start until, August the 12th, I suppose, which was the very first time my squadron intercepted German bombers actually wanting to bomb something in England. Between Dunkirk and August the 12th, it was nothing more than escorting bomber raids or protecting shipping in the Channel. And in that period, the Germans used to try and bomb shipping in the Channel. And they tried to bomb Dover once or twice. So we were either, as I say, doing convoy patrols or escorting bombers to France. And I mean, it didn't happen every day. There must have been one or two days when the weather wasn't suitable for bombing raids on targets in France, so we might have spent the whole day on the ground doing nothing.
Because with the benefits of hindsight, perhaps, people put the boundary line on the Battle of Britain as starting in July and finishing in October. But presumably, to pilots like yourself, you weren't conscious of something called the Battle of Britain.
Not at all. I mean, it was we were just doing a job of work, and it varied from day to day. It got more intense, of course, after I ceased to be an operational pilot. And that's after August the 15th. But up until that time, it was, hardly routine, but a steady series of events.
Can you tell me what happened on those days, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th of August, to you?
Well, I was shot down for the... going back to July, I was shot down for the second time in July in stupid circumstances. I've been kicking myself for the last 49 years. We were in the air, somewhere near Ashford in Kent, I think it was, when we were told over the RT that there were ME-109s beating up Manston Aerodrome. So our leader turned and made towards Manston, and I realised that, well, probably wasn't a good idea, because once there must have been a delay between the shooting happening on the ground and our hearing about it in the air. And therefore, the enemy would be on their way home. So I took my section off to the right towards Deal. And it was a very cloudy day. This is a story very much against myself. There we were, flying along about 7,000 feet, I suppose, looking mostly downwards through gaps in the clouds. But of course, always looking behind. And I took one glance behind, and there were three 109s, I suppose about 400 yards away, diving down onto us. And for the very first time in my operational life, I froze. Most extraordinary feeling. I couldn't move, except that my hand was going like that on the stick. So I was doing gentle banks, left and right. And I was looking straight ahead, motionless apart from that. Well, of course, the inevitable happened. There was one very large bang. My engine stopped. I suddenly realized that I had no rudder control, and also that I had no left-hand aileron control. So my first thought was, I must bail out. But this time I was over the sea, and then the idea of bailing out over the sea didn't appeal. Meanwhile, of course, I was looking round madly. Once again, there wasn't an aircraft to be seen. So I managed to get the aircraft pointing towards the land, and I was losing height. I did my second belly landing in a field not very far from Sandwich Golf Course. And that was really quite amusing, because having come to rest, I started to get out of my aircraft when the hedgerows erupted with brown jobs, the army, headed by an officer, who came running up, stopped a few paces away, looked at me, I'd taken my helmet off by then, and said, "Hello, Douglas, how are you?" And I looked at him and said, "Hello, Bill, how nice to see you." And we'd known each other as territorial soldiers 3 years beforehand in the Artist Rifles. And here he was, guarding Britain with a few soldiers and a few rifles. And there was I, a stricken fighter pilot. I was quite unhurt. So we had a little chat. His troops were very impressed to find that their officer knew the pilot. It was terribly funny. And we walked round my aircraft, and I had been terribly lucky. The shell that had gone through my port wing route and had stopped the engine was a solid shell. How it missed my back, God alone knows. And the shell that had hit me, it was two cannon shells. The shell that had hit me in the tail was an explosive shell and had severed the rudder controls and half severed the elevator controls. So I had to get down in a way, but I just had sufficient control to be able to do that. Well, that was the second time. Now, you were asking me about what happened between August the 12th and August the 15th. Well, I remember August the 12th, because, as I say, that was the first time my squadron had tackled the enemy over England. We were patrolling again over Ashford at about 12,000 feet, when we were told that 20-plus bandits, as they were called, were approaching Deal from the east at 10,000 feet. We were to intercept, so we turned towards Deal. And a few seconds later, there we saw, we counted them, 18 Ju-88s. With a cloud of Me-109s above them. So again, in our innocence, we went round the front of the Ju-88s and started diving on the bombers from the rear. And of course, the Me-109s started to get busy. So we had to mix it with them for a minute or so. But they weren't very keen. I think we shot down a couple. I didn't fire at one of them. I had to manoeuvre rather aggressively towards one of them, but he dived away towards France. So I was left alone in the sky again with the bombers steaming ahead. And I was, I suppose, a couple of thousand feet below them by this time, as a result of all this manoeuvring. So, opening the throttle, I went after them. And they suddenly started to turn. And I realized that if they went on turning, they would cross my bows about half a mile away. So I did a sort of head-on attack. It was an attack from the side. And I never got but nearer than, I suppose, 100 yards. And when I dived away, not wanting to be fired at by the rear gunners, and meanwhile, the port and starboard aircraft of the leading Vic of three had burst away from their formation, because they could see I was firing. But of course I was silly. Having done this attack and dived away, I was again 2,000 or 3,000 feet below the bombers, going in the opposite direction. And by the time I had climbed up again and was on their level, they were still a mile ahead and had bombed Hawkinge, which was where we had taken off from. So it was quite useless trying to catch them up. So that was that. And then I heard over the RT, "Don't land at Hawkinge. The airfield has been bombed." So, of course, being very curious, I flew back to Hawkinge. And there was considerable signs of bomb damage, and the airfield seemed to have molehills on it. So I thought, this looks interesting. So I found I could see a pass between the molehills, and I landed and taxied between the molehills to where I'd taken off from. And somebody, a flight sergeant, I think, came up and said, "I think you'd better take off again very quickly, sir." So I said, "Why?" He said, "You see all those molehills? They're unexploded bombs." Oh, how innocent we were. I hadn't realized this, of course. So I took his advice. I weaved my way through the molehills, found the same avenue between them, and took off rather smartly. Flew back to Biggin Hill. Well, that was that. Quite honestly, I can't remember very much about August the 13th or 14th. But I certainly remember my last operational flight on August the 15th. Well, August the 15th was my last operational flight, and we'd taken off from Biggin Hill to patrol somewhere over East Kent, when we were told to fly towards Harwich, and that Harwich was being bombed. I suppose we were flying at about 15,000 feet. I know I was using oxygen. So up we went towards Harwich and saw nothing. And we just turned around and were coming back again when 4,000 or 5,000 feet higher than we were, I saw a circle of ME-110s. And they quite often defensively flew defensive circles. Anyway, we decided, well, the leader decided to take no notice of them, and we flew on. And I was flying as what the Air Force called RCN Charlie, in other words, by myself, 1,000 or a couple of thousand feet higher than the rest of the squadron and slightly behind, weaving like mad. looking right, left, centre, up, down, mostly back. When suddenly, I, out of the corner of my eye, saw a flash over my left wrist. And the next moment, of course, the cockpit was full of flames, the heat was enormous, and I'd done two things absolutely instinctively. My left hand had gone to the handle of the hood, my right hand had gone to the pin of my harness, and I was pulling with both hands. And the next moment I was out in the open air. I'd made no attempt to jump out of that aircraft, but of course I was straining back from the flames and the heat. What I think had happened was I was doing a left-hand turn and my aircraft had gone on turning over on its back and I'd just fallen out, unless I'd kicked the stick, which would have jerked me upwards and out. Anyway, there I was, falling away. And I did actually remember my parachute drill, which was, of course, to wait before pulling the ripcord for 2 or 3 seconds, and I pulled it, and there was a jerk, and there I was, floating down under a marvellous canopy, and about a couple of miles inland, I could look down and see the land, so I thought, well, at least I won't be going into the sea.